shipping and fishing. They keep the global economy running. But the open seas can be a very bad place to be. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood, filling in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, November 9th, and we're glad you could join us. We'll start our show in Missouri, where Tim Wolf, the president of the University of Missouri, resigned today after weeks of protest against him. Students and staff say Wolf hasn't done enough to combat racism on campus. One student has been on a hunger strike, faculty were about to walk out, and this week at least 30 Missouri football players threatened to strike unless Wolf stepped down. They said they wouldn't participate in team activities, including this weekend's game against BYU. Forfeiting that game would have cost the school a $1 million fine. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR in Baltimore, Amy Scott reports.
On the University of Missouri campus in Columbia today, protesters took a moment to celebrate.
But I want you all to know that this is a movement and not a moment. So I expect to see this all the time.
That's student Andrea Fulgham. But Scott Brooks, an associate professor of Black Studies and Sociology at the university, says the big moment came when football was in jeopardy.
We can only speculate what the conversation was, but there's no doubt that we're a business and we're looking to make money. That is why we have big-time college sports.
The university's now former president, Tim Wolf, knows well the economic power of college sports. He earned the ire of many students by pushing a $72 million expansion of the football stadium. At the same time, he raised tuition and tried to close the university press. He also cut healthcare subsidies for graduate students.
He's a businessman, and that's kind of the model for higher education these days.
Connor Lewis is a doctoral student at Missouri and an organizer with the Forum on Graduate Rights. He says there's no doubt the football boycott made a difference.
But also, I think it was really the buy-in from pretty much every level of the university.
Including head football coach Gary Pinkel. Kenneth Shropshire teaches the business of sports at Wharton.
That's kind of the broader impact, too. Not just the we won't have our games on Saturday, but the recognition of what these young men bring to campuses.
Shropshire says this could begin to level the playing field for college athletes who've been fighting for a bigger voice of their own in big money sports. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Public radio station KBIA helped us out with that story. The talk on Wall Street today is about those end-of-the-year bonuses and not about how great they'll be. A new report predicts many bankers will see smaller payouts, up to 20% smaller for some. Now, if you and your family don't work on Wall Street, you probably aren't crying a lot of tears over banker bonuses. But bonus culture is becoming a bigger deal in lots of jobs. In fact, one consultant says companies are setting aside record amounts of money for bonus payouts, but those same companies are also spending less on raises than they used to. Marketplace's Mark Garrison has more on that.
A recent Aon Hewitt study found firms are devoting 12.9% of their payroll budgets to bonuses and other variable pay, an all-time high. 20 years ago, that number was 7.6%. Lots of factors are driving this move from annual raises toward bonuses. But no surprise, it's largely companies looking to save money. Gene Phillips is a professor at Penn State School of Labor and Employment Relations.
Now that budgets are tight, the economy isn't doing as well as many were hoping it would by now. I think that they're having to be creative in how they invest the resources that they do have.
Paying bonuses gives managers more flexibility to pull back during difficult years. Companies also believe bonuses help recruitment.
They're trying to attract, retain, and motivate a certain type of worker.
Michigan State professor Felice Klein studies compensation.
The highest quality workers actually like these pay-for-performance type systems because essentially they can be rewarded for performing very well.
But bonuses also create anxious employees who can't easily plan ahead when they don't know what they'll make. Even when their personal performance is strong, bonuses won't be fat if the company struggles overall. Barry Gerhardt is a University of Wisconsin business professor.
It's obviously very difficult when profits drop. If your bonus goes away and you know, you still have your mortgage payments, your utility payments, and everything else.
Measuring performance becomes increasingly important as bonuses creep beyond Wall Street. Bankers' output isn't that hard to nail down. In other jobs, it's harder to tell, including for those HR execs who change your pay policy. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, blame the bonus news or the Fed. Either way, it's all in the red. We'll have more when we do the numbers. For more than a year, New York Times reporter Ian Urbina has been investigating what he calls the outlaw ocean, the wild and often lawless world of the high seas, and the network of fishing and cargo ships that bring food and goods to your local supermarket or shopping mall. He's told four stories so far of slavery, pollution, piracy, and murder. The fifth installment of the series is out today. It's about the predatory labor market for ocean workers and a young Filipino man who went looking for work and didn't come home alive. Ian Urbina is here now to tell us more. Ian, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
So this installment tells this truly horrific story about a man named Errol Andrade who was living in the Philippines and went to work at sea. Will you tell us first what happened to him?
He was recruited locally, thought that he was headed off to sea to make maybe $500 a month. He was put in an apartment with about 20 other men where they were all locked in during the day, in a pretty gruesome place where there was sexual pressure from the manager who ran the apartment. If you wanted the better jobs and he selected you, then sex was forced upon you, according to several of the men. They waited there for some of them for weeks, in Errol's case for about a week, and then shipped out to the assigned ship. In his case, he went to a Taiwanese tuna longliner. Then our trail goes a little bit cold in terms of our ability to track Errol specifically. All we know is that about 10 months later, he appears back in port and he's dead. And his body is covered in bruises and cuts. He's missing his pancreas and one of his eyes. And that's the end of his story.
And he went off on this voyage because he wanted to fix his mom's leaky roof, right? That's what he was trying to accomplish?
That's right. Yeah. So Errol had been bouncing around as a security guard, making very little money, working in the family's rice paddy, bored and sort of aimless. And Errol's main goal was to see the world and also to earn a bit of money to fix up that house because it had a leaking roof and they get a lot of rain there. And that was his main ambition.
And so you say it was this staffing company, Step Up, that put Errol Andrade on this ship. Tell us about that company and how they operate.
So Step Up Marine Enterprise is a company that's been around since about 1990. It's a recruitment firm. It finds workers and puts them on ships and handles their salaries and their paychecks and their plane fare. And this is the company that has been involved in a bunch of trafficking cases over the years, including Errol's. That's how he found out about the job. And that's who, you know, runs the apartment in Singapore where he waited to get placed on the ship.
And so why is it that companies like Step Up can then get away with things like Andrade's death or this ongoing abuse or just bilking of workers?
The ocean is this distinct workplace, right? It's huge. And those who work there are transient by definition, and they're often on vessels that are multinational. So the crew's from maybe three different countries, and the officers are from another, and the ship's owned by a third. And so then you have these manning agencies, which are typically based in one country, so Step Up's in Singapore, but they're recruiting from another country, in this case, the Philippines. In Errol Andrade's case, there's no extradition treaty between the Philippines and Singapore. So even though the head of this company, the Singapore-based company, Step Up, has been charged in absentia by Philippine authorities, they have no ability to bring him back to justice and try him.
How common do you think stories like this are?
More common than I thought as I headed there. We thought we would maybe get a half dozen stories from people in this one village. And virtually everyone we met introduced us to someone else until we essentially ran out of time. All of them, to a man, had not finished their 3-year contract and had come back early, which meant they received no wages whatsoever.
Ian Urbina from the New York Times, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You should read that story and the whole series. We have the links at marketplace.org. If you date online, you probably use one of the sites or apps controlled by the Match Group. The brand owns Match.com, Tinder, OkCupid, Plenty of Fish, and it's going public. The Barry Diller-controlled company hopes to raise nearly $500 million in the IPO, but as it starts its speed dating with investors, if you will, there's an interesting red flag in the company's filing papers. Online dating has a tech problem, and it's email. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has more.
Just look at the demographics. This can be a lucrative business. Aaron Smith at the Pew Research Center says participation in online dating sites doubled from 2009 to 2013. And
about one out of five people in their mid-20s to mid-40s say that they use online dating.
A lot of them have also been willing to pay to be on these sites. But Match Group acknowledges it has a potential problem because its sites depend heavily on email to tell users about potential dates and mates and also to market money-making features and upgrades. Jack Myers is author of Hooked Up, about young consumers.
The younger generation has moved off of email in the same way they've moved off of phone calls. They text. They use Instagram, Snapchat. Their social media use has shifted completely, and it's unlikely it'll ever go back.
So, what's a dating site to do? Bill Carter at youth marketing firm Fuse says they'll have to reach out to customers where they are online. And for social life, it's most likely to be a messaging platform or app. For instance, he says, use geolocation and send a Snapchat or Facebook message.
Right now, you have three people that have looked at your profile within 5 miles of you. You know, click on one of their profiles and connect.
Carter says young people want marketing communication that's specific and useful to them, whatever the social media platform. And then they'll be happy to get it, maybe even pay for it. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up,
she would definitely get upset and yell and scream.
I mean, yes, I don't consider him a good person.
Mean bosses. I wouldn't know anything about that at all. Seriously, though, more on mean bosses coming up. But first, let's do the numbers. Numbers are down. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 179 points, 1%, to close at 17,730. The NASDAQ gave back 51 points, also 1%, to finish at 5095. And the S&P 500 declined 20 points, 0.9%, to end at 2078. Volkswagen announced today it will offer $1,000 gift cards to U.S. owners of certain diesel models involved in that emissions scandal. Half of the card, though, has to be spent at a VW or Audi dealership. Volkswagen stock reversed 1.2%. Lots of bank stocks tumbled today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.35%. And you're listening to Marketplace. You're listening to Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. Refugees from Syria continue to flow into Europe, and aid organizations are gearing up for a long and overwhelming winter. But it's not just food, water, and blankets that they're preparing. As crucial as those things are, this is a modern refugee crisis, and the need for technology can be just as great. Marketplace's Sally Herships has more.
Imagine you're going on a long trip, really, really far from home, and you're a refugee. You'll need help. But what you ask for today is different than it would have been just 10 years ago.
So what people are demanding more and more is not only, you know, classic food, shelter, water, healthcare, but they demand Wi-Fi.
And charging stations for their phones. Melita Sunich is with the United Nations in Germany. She says she worked in Amman with refugees after they'd just crossed the border. Many were from rural areas with basic cell phones. But
the refugees we're looking at now who are coming to Europe, this is a completely different story.
Sunich says they're middle class, urban people, and they're bringing their smartphones to call home, to map their routes. She says even smugglers have their own Facebook pages.
I don't remember a crisis where or a refugee group where modern technology played such a role.
Emily Eros is with the Red Cross in Hungary. She says the organization is working on the basics, food, water, and shelter, but it's also helping refugees stay connected.
It's a little bit difficult because it's not just a matter of getting a Wi-Fi station up. It's also a matter of having someone there who's able to fix it if something goes wrong.
Kate Coyer is director of the Civil Society and Technology Project at Central European University in Hungary. It's also helping to keep refugees connected.
There's two kind of distinct problems, really. How do you bring Wi-Fi to places? And then also, how do you bring in electricity or ways that people can actually charge their phones?
Coyer says as borders and routes constantly change, it becomes both more important and difficult to share information. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Elsewhere in Europe, the Kilkenomics Festival is in swing in Ireland. It's where economics and comedy meet. It's been described as the Davos World Economic Forum, but with jokes. This year, the stars of the festival are the bad boy former finance minister of Greece and Ireland's gradually improving economy. The BBC's Manuela Saragossa reports from Kilkenny, Ireland.
Yiannis Varoufakis, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you, everyone.
Critics accused him of exacerbating Greece's economic turmoil. The European Union's establishment loathed him, but pundits here at the Kilkenomics Festival certainly don't. Ever since stepping down as Greece's finance minister earlier this year, Yiannis Varoufakis has joined the ranks of the world's celebrity economists. In office, he was famous for rejecting the demands of Greece's creditors, the so-called troika of the European Union, European Central Bank and IMF. And on that front, Yiannis Varoufakis has no regrets.
The reason why I resigned was because I was refusing. You know, finance ministers are the ones that sign the loan agreements. It's not the prime minister, it's not the president of the republic, it is not the culture minister, it's the hapless finance minister. And I was a very curious and weird finance minister in the sense that I was refusing to sign another loan until and unless I had some evidence that there was a significant probability that we'd be able to repay it.
So what message did Yiannis Varoufakis have for his Irish audience? Well, he worries about the future of the Eurozone, and he said he would understand if Britons voted to leave the EU in their referendum next year.
If I were a Brit, I must confess that in the polling station next year, whenever the referendum takes place, my arm would be going towards the no vote, get out. But I hope that my head would restrain my arm and move to the yes. Even though I am the last person to defend Brussels and the European Union, a fragmentation of the European Union is going to unleash centrifugal forces that we cannot control.
Both Greece and Ireland were bailed out by the EU at about the same time. So why is it that the Irish economy is now recovering while the Greek economy is still shrinking? I asked the Irish economist David McWilliams, who set up the Kilkenomics Festival 6 years ago.
The one thing to understand is that despite pretending that we're Europeans, we're not really. It's very something to understand. The Irish economy is part of the Anglo-American economy. I mean, it's kind of Connecticut with bad weather here, if you really think about it, because most of our investment is American. Our biggest trading partner is still Britain in terms of imports. Our biggest trading partners are America and Britain. Our cultural links are with Canada, with Britain, with America. Basically, we're an Atlantic race, an Atlantic economy. And so what you find is that when the American economy in certain sectors are doing well, we do extremely well.
So does that explain why, for example, Greece is still struggling and why Ireland has had a recovery?
You should always regard Ireland as being like a state somewhere between Britain and the United States with a German currency grafted onto it. So if you want to get your head around that, okay? Our cultural and economic and financial connections are with the Anglo-American world.
That was the BBC's Manuela Saragossa reporting. And now let's talk a little bit about management. You know, bosses. The bad kind. We've all had them. And Marketplace's Sabri Benachour reports that we're not imagining it. There are a lot of jerks out there.
I want you to think about all of the bosses you've ever had. Would you say that any of them were utter, total...
I might if I used that sort of language.
I'm pretty sure just about everybody has had, at some point, a complete jerk for a boss.
She would definitely get upset and yell and scream.
Texted people
2 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning.
And put me and my colleagues down.
And if you didn't respond within half an hour, you would be given a warning.
I mean, yes, I don't consider him a good person.
Most of these people didn't want to be identified because their bosses are jerks, among other reasons. Now, this jerk boss problem is not some kind of accident. At least a lot of researchers don't think so. It may not come as a total surprise, but there's a lot of research that suggests being a jerk can actually help you become a boss. Not a good boss, but a boss.
If you look at these traits, such as being Machiavellian, narcissistic, you will find that most of these traits tend to have short-term advantages.
Dr. Tomas Chamorro-Primusic is CEO of Hogan Assessments. It's a consulting firm that helps companies develop talent.
Some of these attributes help people get to a position of power and navigate their careers upwards, but at the same time, they don't really contribute to leadership effectiveness or management effectiveness, which is why you find so many bosses that are assholes.
It's not that hard to understand how this works. Take narcissists, people who are super egocentric and usually insecure at the same time.
Let's just take a door-to-door salesperson.
Murray Barrick is head of the Center for Human Resource Management at Texas A&M.
You know, door-to-door salespeople get rejected all the time, but a narcissistic door-to-door salesperson actually can handle that rejection much better, because a narcissistic salesperson would say, you're not rejecting me because of me. You're rejecting me because you're dumb or something.
Same thing for entrepreneurs and corporate leaders. Being narcissistic, or in some cases a sociopath, can be helpful in interviews too.
When you first meet a narcissist, they tend to make a positive impression on you.
Emily Grijalva is assistant professor at the University at Buffalo School of Management. She did a meta-analysis of 18 studies with 30,000 test subjects and found narcissism increases your chances of becoming a leader.
So if you were to meet someone narcissistic at a party, you'd probably think they were really entertaining and attractive.
She says narcissists tend to be better dressed, have better posture, and be charming. Some sociopaths can do this too.
They're going to portray themselves as being a leader.
These people believe that they're good.
Jeannie Brantover is a managing partner at Boyden Global Executive Search. She described her former boss earlier. She says confidence does not equal competence.
These people aren't, they're not really imposters. You know, when I interview people, they really believe in themselves, you know, whether someone is, you know, an egomaniac, just not a good person, you know, they truly have bought into whoever they are.
Now, here's where it's not totally the narcissist or the sociopath or the jerk's fault. Part of the problem, many researchers argue, is that we think wrongly that jerks make good leaders. So even if we have an inkling that someone is a boorish, maniacal brute, we're somehow drawn in.
Showing that kind of asshole behavior matches up to this bad idea that is embraced in the business world that the most effective leader is the hard-nosed driver.
Fred Keel is the author of The Return on Character and founder of KRW International. They help develop leadership inside companies.
So they're a little rough on people. At least they're taking action.
Tomas Chamorro-Primusic says that because of this jerk effect, bosses are actually more likely to fail.
There's a lot of data on this. In general, bosses perform pretty poorly. If you look at large corporations in the past 5 years, on average, they have all fired around 15 to 20% of senior leaders, so C-suites, you know, CEO, COO, and so forth.
The sad thing about jerk bosses, and this is actually one of the things that can do them in the end, is that they don't really take cues or criticism. In fact, if you are a jerk, narcissistic boss listening to this story, you're probably going to think it's about your boss, when actually, it's about you. In New York, I'm Sabri Benashour for Marketplace. And this is not about Marketplace or anywhere else I have ever worked.
Now, Sabri actually made some charts all by himself about narcissistic bosses. You can find those at marketplace.org. I really think he's trying to tell us something. This final note before we go, SeaWorld said today that it will cancel its trained killer whale performances at its San Diego park. SeaWorld will launch a, quote, new orca experience in 2017 that it says will focus more on the natural environment and behavior of killer whales. The SeaWorld Orca show has been both controversial and less popular in the last couple of years. A CNN documentary called Blackfish caused protests and criticism over the park's treatment of whales, and regulators have refused to approve a $100 million expansion of that San Diego park unless SeaWorld stops breeding or capturing new orcas. The company did not say whether it would stop its trained orca shows in its Orlando or San Antonio parks.
Marketplace is supported by Palo Alto Networks and the New York Stock Exchange's definitive guide for executive leaders navigating the digital age, paloaltonetworks.com/nextgenceo. And by Curious.com, helping people learn more than 17,000 skills like Excel, electric guitar, and entrepreneurship. Learn more at Curious.com/APM. And by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, working to unleash the immune system's power to fight cancer and develop promising new therapies. More at discovercarebelieve.org.
Today, the Dow lost 179 points, or 1%. The NASDAQ gave back 51 points, also 1%. And the S&P 500 declined 20 points, 0.9%. Our daily production team includes Tommy Andres, Bridget Bodner, Robert Garova, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Molly Wood, and we'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.